Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, Tim Tebow has some interesting things to say about amateurism. We'll talk about that. Eli Manning getting put on the pine. We will talk about that. But first, these NFL players got the audacity to say that they don't want to play places anymore, right? In the end, they're not really doing that much other than saying, I don't want to be here no more. And not everybody is ready for that. If you don't believe that not everybody is ready for that, I got a little sound for you here from Steve Young from last night's Monday Night Football pregame.
There's no mobility. It's like, where are you going to go? It is now the NBA. I think, obviously, Antonio Brown proved it. He's ended up in the Patriots. Just act that way, and you end up in the Patriots. And look what the Dolphins did. Lose a game, the first game, like, call my agent. I want out of here. This is the NBA now, and front office of the NFL are going to have to deal the fact that if you lose a couple games or get into all sideline altercation, that guy's going to demand a trade. He's a big name. What are you going to do about it? And I think at this point, it seems like they're capitulating to it. They didn't put on a hard line. There's no one going to be traded. They're going to have to come together as a league and say, we're not going to do this because it'll be insane. Every guy that's on a bad team's like, get me out of here. Give me the Patriots. Give me the Chiefs. Call their agent and they'll start talking about it and then it'll become true.
Ooh, boy, people start losing their minds when somebody has the nerve to look around and realize I actually have a little more flex in this situation than I had given myself credit for having. It's a little stunning, I have to say, to hear Steve Young say that in the ways that he did. It's stunning generally for me to hear former players who seem to have a certain measure of resentment for the idea that players are out here trying to make things happen for themselves. Now, I would also like to note here that I don't think that what's happening here right now with NFL players and asking for trades is really that new, right? Like, I mean, kind of, sort of, but not really that new. Why I say that's not really that new, I can think in my mind of dudes, you know, of course, holdouts, obviously, but I can think of cats like Eric Dickerson basically forcing themselves out of places that they were. I can think about a guy like Steve Young. I'm reading this now. This is a article from the San Francisco Chronicle printed August 6, 2005. And it says here, it's a good thing the statute of limitations has expired. Bill Walsh's 1987 to pursue a trade for Steve Young to the 49ers was clinched when he arranged for Young, still under contract with Tampa Bay, to work out privately for him in Utah. Are you telling me that that wasn't some measure of flex from Steve Young, who looked around the terrible team that he was on in Tampa Bay and decided that he wanted to be somewhere else? Are you serious? So, like, is it different because Steve Young managed to get it to a place where Bill Walsh did the dirty work for him? Like, those seem to be the same thing to me. Now, here's what the next, one of the next paragraphs in that story says. It says, the Cardinals had offered a first round pick. Young, put off by the Cardinals' long record of ineptitude, did not want to go there. He got the late Hugh Culverhouse, Tampa Bay's owner, to honor a pledge Culverhouse had made when he signed Young. If it didn't work out, he would allow Young some leeway in working out a deal. So basically what you're telling me is, for you, Steve Young, in 1987, it was always like the NBA. So is the problem now that the dudes who are asking for trades are not Steve Young? Therefore, you're like, oh my gosh, they have to put their foot down? Like, you actually got an owner to say, if it's not working out, maybe we can come up with a deal. What is working out? Like, what exactly would that mean? Right? Young wanted to get out of Tampa Bay so bad, he went to be, in effect, Joe Montana's backup. Now, I know that part of the plan for Walsh was always for Young to be the starter because that Montana had some physical issues. And then it took 4 years. It went until 91 that Walsh became, Young became the starter. But bro, you did this yourself. This is the same exact game that you managed to play. Look, Young even said it in there. The teams don't have to capitulate on these moves. These trades that we're talking about now where guys are getting moved, let's think about what the circumstances are and let's be real about the fact that they're ultimately doing things that the teams want done. So Antonio Brown says, I want to be traded. It seemed pretty obvious that the Steelers wanted to get him out of there, right? Like, they didn't seem like they were like, okay, I guess we got no choice but to do this. They're like, are you mean, if that's what you want to do, Antonio, I guess we can come up with a way to get you out of here. Minka Fitzpatrick looked around at a team that wasn't trying to win and is like, why am I here and why am I going to put up bad film? I would like to be traded. And the Dolphins are like, you know, the last thing we need here are good players. Like, what are we doing with a good player? We can get him out of there. And it served the needs of the team and the player that he then wound up being traded. We just found out that Jalen Ramsey looked around in Jacksonville and was like, nah, dog, I would like to be traded out of here after having a bit of an altercation with his head coach on the sideline. But stop and think about this for a second. Jalen Ramsey went in the 2016 draft. Number one pick in the 2016 draft, Jared Goff, already gotten an extension. Number two pick in that draft, Carson Wentz, already gotten an extension. The number four pick in that draft, Ezekiel Elliott, already gotten himself an extension. The number five pick in that draft, Jalen Ramsey, whom you could make an argument is the best player of all of them. Obviously, quarterbacks get a certain premium, but you can make the argument that he's the best player of all of those guys. And Jacksonville's like, nope, we're not going to give you an extension now. That doesn't sound to me like Jacksonville really wants to keep Jalen Ramsey that bad. So when Jalen Ramsey walks in and says, I would like a trade, I feel like if you're Tom Coughlin, you got to pretend like this ain't the best news you got all day. Right? You got a team that's probably not going to do anything this year. You could probably get yourself a first-round pick for Ramsey.
Hey, well, I mean, that's what you say you want, Jalen. Oh, okay. Well, all right. Well, I guess we'll bring you in here. Okay, cool. And they're probably going to wind up getting a number one pick for him. Right?
Like, it would be different if you were talking about these guys coming in and pulling off, like, full-on shakedowns on NFL teams. That's not happening. The closest thing that we had to a shakedown on one of these is actually Jadeveon Clowney getting moved to Seattle, although part of that was the technicality of the fact that they could not trade him until he signed the franchise tender, which then allowed him to basically maneuver where it was that he wanted to go. But the franchise tag is normally the flex the owners have that make it where they don't have to do anything like this. What happened with Clowney, or what seems to have happened with Clowney, this is the only thing I can surmise, and this is also based somewhat on a couple people I've talked to, but I can't, like, nothing I can come to you and say is factual, but I feel fairly confident putting things together to say that I think what happened there was Houston looked up and realized this dude isn't going to play for us this year. Like, it's just not going to happen. He's not going to play for us this year. So we might as well move him now because it's not happening. And then they wound up getting a third-round pick. You could say, well, the third-round pick was going to be a compensatory pick they would have gotten for him anyway, but this pick is going to be higher. I think the compensatory picks come at the end of the round. So this pick winds up being higher than the one that they were going to get. Like, yo, man, these dudes are not destroying the system. Like, the whole thing is not on fire right now. You have had some guys who have looked around and said, hey, man, I'd like to be traded. But in the end, the teams have still looked at the deals and said to themselves, yeah, this will probably be good for us. All right. Now, the best argument you can make about a team making a trade that maybe wasn't so great for them would be Pittsburgh as it related to Antonio Brown. But I think they just wanted that dude out of there. And I think everything that's happened since has indicated to us why it is that they wanted that dude out of there. So you're like, oh, they only got a third and a fifth. Okay, maybe, but also don't forget, if they had been willing to do a trade with the Patriots, and I don't blame them for not being willing to do so, but if they had been willing to do a trade with the Patriots, they probably could have gotten a first-round pick for Antonio Brown. That's not a shakedown. That's not the team being, like, held over the fire and daring them to do something. No, that's not what it is. You could kind of sort of make the argument that that is what happened with the Raiders. Right? Because, I mean, that's the thing Steve Young said is I could be like Antonio Brown. I could come in, I can act like this, and I can get traded. And then he says, well, then Minkah Fitzpatrick looks around and says, call my agent, get me out of here. The Minkah Fitzpatrick situation is totally different than what happened with Antonio Brown with the Raiders. It's 100% different than what happened there. Like, if you make the argument that Antonio Brown found a way to raise hell and get out of there, okay, that's one thing. That is not the same as Fitzpatrick being like, yo, dog, I want to be traded, because he didn't really do anything that made it happen. Right? Like, he didn't do anything that really pushed himself out of there. He just looked around and saw a common interest. I want to be good at football. You don't. How about we find a place that lets me be better at football and allows you to be worse? Boom. Done. Problem solved. Trade made. But let me ask this, and I know I'm not the only person that's got this question, and it's a very simple question. It's a question I think that should be asked. Pretty simple. Why is the comparison always to the NBA?
That was going to be my follow-up. Didn't you think that was a little cheap?
But here's why it gets me that it's always about the NBA. And it's very cheap. But the forerunner of, like, player rights is Major League Baseball. The guys that got the most clout are Major League Baseball players. And while you can talk about the NBA players having the ability to flex and force a trade, baseball players for the longest have had the biggest flex, which was the you can't trade me flex. The no trade clause. The 10-5 clause. Gave you up on the 10-5 clause?
I am not.
10-5 clause is basically if you've been in the league for 10 years and with the same team for 5, then you get a no trade clause.
Yes, got it. Okay.
Right? And so what happens very often is as those guys get up close to either the 10 or the 5, then they wind up getting moved. But everybody basically does the same thing if they're trying to get shipped out of there, which is I'm not going to sign an extension with you. And you look and you realize, oh, damn, we might as well get something for him while we can. And then the trade winds up happening. This is what it is. But why is the idea that players might have the ability to do something about where it is that they play? I don't understand why that brings out such a level of resentment in people. Like, I just don't get why they're just like, oh my gosh, we can't have that. Like Steve Young was saying there, no, the owners are going to have to shut this down. You know the way that you shut this down? You know how you make it where Minkah Fitzpatrick doesn't want to be traded? Don't make the obvious decision that you don't want to win. Right? You want to make it where Jalen Ramsey doesn't request a trade? You might want to create a cultural situation where he and the head coach aren't screaming at each other on the sideline and where the defense doesn't feel betrayed by the offense that's on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think is interesting here. And correct me if I'm wrong in this, but all of these players that have requested trades, if they, you know, if their teams had created an environment where they would have wanted to stay and also paid them when they asked and warranted a new contract, they would have stayed, yeah. Right?
And also, yes, I agree with that. And here's the other thing about this NBA comparison. So, like, Anthony Davis, I guess, is the one that people are really jumping to. But correct me if I'm wrong, Gabe. Didn't Anthony Davis basically just tell them, I'm not going to re-sign here?
Yeah, he just wanted to go to the Lakers. It's not like the Pelicans weren't going to pay him, like, oh, you know, he wants a new deal with the Pelicans, but they're not going to pay him. So he's like, all right, I'll go to L.A.
Yeah, he's like, yo, I don't want to play here anymore. And if you want me to stick out this contract, fine. But after this contract, I'm going to go there. What Paul George said that got him out of Indiana was, hey, I want to go play for the Lakers. And they were like, oh, why are we going to let you walk? We're going to trade you and get something for you. Then the thing that happened with the Thunder, I'm convinced of this, man. If he didn't walk up to the Thunder with such a great idea, the Thunder don't trade him and we don't ever find out about the demand in the first place. You know what I mean? Like, yo, this is what it is. They have the littlest bit of leverage in this, and the guys are using it in the basic idea that they would consider having their own thoughts and trying to make their own moves. It's out here driving people crazy. And I just don't know how you're not looking at yourself like, well, what is the problem that I actually have with the fact that people are doing this? I had some guy get in my mentions on Twitter, and his argument was that, well, he doesn't like it with the NBA because you got to look up in the NBA and you don't ever know who's playing for a team from year to year because the guys are moving so much. Well, sir, I suggest that you get you like an ESPN.com subscription or something like that. In fact, you ain't even got to get a subscription. Just check the website regularly. They got news about the trades all the time. Like, who? Like, what? Nobody turning on the Timberwolves in 2007 and being like, damn, what happened to Kevin Garnett? Why is Al Jefferson on the floor? You knew what happened to Kevin Garnett. Like, there wasn't no mystery to that. But you know what league has the greatest mystery about who's playing for a team from year to year? The NFL. As it stands right now, the first 3 weeks of the season for me are when I realized just how many wide receivers there are in the league, because I ain't never heard of dudes that be on these squads. What was this dude name? The Michael Gallo that played for the Cowboys? He balled week one. Never heard of that dude one time in my life. Raiders got a dude named Tyrell Williams. Never heard of that dude in my life. And apparently that dude had 1,000-yard receiving in 2006 for the Chargers. I'd never heard of that cat before in my life. Don't get out here telling me that you got a problem with the idea that you can't remember who plays for anybody. NFL, man, these cats out here dropping like flies. Y'all turn on the television to watch it when dudes get their legs broken in half and everything else. You don't care, right? Your problem is not with I can't recognize the players. Your problem is subtly and subconsciously you can't grasp the idea that these players actually might have some of their own personal agency and might be able to make something work. You understand that it's a business when the teams do something that basically inflicts some measure of injury to the player, right? Then it's just business. When the player try to come up with something for themselves that is also just business, now you're going to catch an attitude. Why you got an attitude? How you got an attitude? That doesn't make any sense. Well, it kind of does. But anyway, yo, so what's the big deal? Because Steve Young said it right.
The teams don't have to capitulate. The teams don't have to do this. And you want an example of a team that's not doing such a thing? Why don't you go look down in San Diego and ask Melvin Gordon about all the flex and power that he's got? While he's sitting over there at the crib, watching games, watching his backup tear it up. Why don't you go ask him about the power that he's got to get himself traded? Nah, man, that's not how this goes. As these things have stood presently, each team that has made one of these trades has made a trade that was beneficial to the team, right? Now, if you want to talk about like some NBA situations, because the thing with the NBA also is it's hard to get equal value for a star player. Like New Orleans seemed to have figured out a way to do it, but it's hard to do it historically. Like you think about the Shaq trade for Caron Butler, Lamar Odom, and Brian Grant for a 2004 version of Shaq. No, it's not equal value, but there's no way you're really getting equal value for Shaq at that point in time. Charles Barkley being traded from Philadelphia to Phoenix for Andrew Lang, Tim Perry, and Jeff Hornacek. Okay, if these NFL teams were getting stuck with deals like that, I'd be here to listen to you. That's not what's happening. So is your problem really just the mere idea that these cats are flexing? Right? Is your problem the mere idea that they have the nerve to say, hey, I don't want to play here anymore? And I want you to think about something else, too, when it comes to Minkah Fitzpatrick. Y'all swear up and down y'all want players who want to win. Y'all swear up and down that winning should be the only thing that matters to a player. We tell you a story about a dude that looks around at his team and says, this team has no chance to win. I'm about winning. Send me somewhere I might have a chance to win. And now you got an attitude. So do you understand why it sounds to me like what you have a problem with is the players and not the game, right? Because the game is the game. Now the players are playing it in a way that works for them. In a way, by the way, that most of them had the ability to do in the first place. So ask yourself for real, what is your problem? Because your problem, to me, is a problem. All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk about what Tim Tebow was saying about playing college ball. Anyway, but first, hiring can be a slow process. Cafe El Toro's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BOMANI. ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Ooh, boy. Tim Tebow sent the internet into a tizzy last week. People was mad. A whole lot of people that work here was mad. I don't think I was mad. I was laughing. But he got people a little mad. And, you know, California passed that law. We talked about that last week on the show, right?
Yes.
Yeah, California passed that law about players making money off their likenesses and, you know, and all that stuff, right? It passed that law. And Tim Tebow was on First Take, and they asked him about it. And this is what Tim Tebow had to say.
I feel like I have a little credibility and knowledge about this because when I was at the University of Florida, I think my jersey was one of the top selling jerseys around the world. It was like Kobe, LeBron, and then I was right behind them and I didn't make a dollar from it, but nor did I want to because I knew going into college what it was all about. I knew going to Florida, my dream school, where I wanted to go, the passion for it. And if I could support my team, support my college, support my university, that's what it's all about. But now we're changing it from my university, from being an alumni where I care, which makes college football and college sports special, to then, okay, it's not about us, it's not about we, it's just about me. And yes, I know we live in a selfish culture where it's all about us, but we're just adding and piling it onto that, where it changes what's special about college football. We turn it into the NFL, where who has the most money, that's where you go. That's why people are more passionate about college sports than they are about NFL. That's why the stadiums are bigger in college than they are in the NFL, because it's about your team. It's about your university. It's about where my family wanted to go. It's about where my grandfather had a dream of seeing Florida win an SEC championship. And you're taking that away so that young kids can earn a dollar. And that's just not where I feel like college football needs to go.
That's fair,
there's
man.
That opportunity in the NFL,
that's
but
fair.
Not in college football.
Dog, I don't ever want to sound that passionate about being broke. Gabe, I need you to help me out with this. If ever you hear it and it sound like it's me on the radio and I sound so excited about being broke and about keeping people broke, you need to call 911 because it ain't me, right? Somebody done put something in my blood or something to get me so excited about talking about being broke.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong here, but he's not exactly passionate about being broke because he's not broke. He's got money, right?
Well, there is that, right? He is not broke. There is that part. Okay. So this is an issue I've talked about many, many times. And I have a lot of different, like, there are different points that come up in issues. And one thing I want to be clear about, because I do agree with you, Gabe, that it's easy for him to talk about his passion about being broke because he did not grow up broke. But I do think that we have a tendency when we respond to people like Tim Tebow about these matters to put it in the context of the poverty of the players. We're like, you know, if you had come where they came from, you'd view it differently, da, da, da. But here's the thing. I didn't come from where those guys came from. My upbringing was probably closer to where Tim Tebow's was than the average college football player that you're imagining in your head when you think about this argument. And I can see that those dudes deserve to get paid, right? This isn't a matter just about getting guys above the poverty line or anything like this. This is about paying what you owe, right? This is about the basic idea that these players are the engine that generates the entertainment that creates these billions of dollars. And as a result, they should be paid more than just a scholarship. Right? That's what the argument comes down to. That argument applies to Tim Tebow. That argument applies to the broke dude. That argument applies to everybody, that you deserve this, right? Now, where Tebow comes from an interesting place in this is that he really, really, really believes in, like, the University of Florida. You know what I mean? Like he's really into that. And he's like, Florida, my dream school. Then why'd you almost go to Alabama? But Florida, my dream school and everything else. And, like, where my grandfather dreamed of Florida winning the SEC championship. And I said this on Twitter. I phrased it poorly, but people, you get my point on this. My grandfather did not dream of, they from Louisiana, they did not dream of LSU winning no championship because they couldn't go to LSU. You know what I mean? Like, he's coming from a perspective that is really not in line with a lot of the people who play these games, for a lot of these people who are being recruited to come in and make this money for everybody else. The other thing for Tebow is, Tebow may not have been able to monetize his name and likeness while he was at Florida, but his last year at Florida was 2009, which is to say he has been monetizing his name and likeness for the last 9 years. Everything that Tim Tebow has professionally is on the basis of being Tim Tebow, Heisman Trophy winning quarterback. That's where it comes from, right? It ain't about half a season in the NFL. It ain't about what he's over there doing in baseball. He has been able to monetize his name and likeness after the fact in a way that most people can't, right? Like, it doesn't matter how good they were. Most people cannot. I have said for the majority of my life that Tommy Frazier was the best quarterback I ever saw play college football. Tommy Frazier from Nebraska. Gabe, you never heard of Tommy Frazier, had you?
I have.
Okay, you've heard of him, but, like, you ain't got no, like, frame of reference on him.
No idea.
Right, right. And I'm not saying that to knock you for being young. I'm just making a point. You were born in what, like, 92?
91.
Right. So it don't, like, Tommy Frazier doesn't mean anything to you now. There is no place for Tommy Frazier to push his brand outside of the state of Nebraska, basically. Right? I'm sure he's a man around there. Outside of that, he can't really do nothing to make that work. He can't. Tebow is in a unique position where he has been able to. Johnny Manziel is going to be able, whatever money he's really going to make down the line, is going to be on the basis of being Johnny Football. It ain't going to be about anything he did in the NFL. That cat's going to be able to make that money.
Not everybody's going to be able to do that. Not everybody gets to defer that. Not everybody gets to push that down the line. Most of them are as marketable and invaluable as people as they're going to be, or as like, you know, pitchman type stuff or whatever. But they're going to be as valuable monetarily in college as they are ever. And in college, they're going out of their way to keep money out of their pockets. And the counter argument that always comes up is basically what you're getting is enough. That is the argument that you get. What you are getting is enough. Now, I am going to take this to that place that makes a lot of people uncomfortable, but it's impossible to do this without talking about race. And part of why it's impossible to do this without talking about race is I've seen studies that have indicated that people's attitudes about paying college athletes are very much so tied to their attitudes about, like, race stuff. And that the more racial animus you held, the more likely you are to oppose paying players, right? Now, is it a correlation to causation? I'm not sure. I'm just telling you, you can Google this idea and you'll come back with these studies. Like, I'm not making this up. And if you don't believe that, I'll give you something here to consider. Because the idea that they're getting, like, as I say, yo, these athletes need to get paid. And the flip side is they are getting paid. They get to go to school for free, right? Fundamentally, the argument is that this barter system where they get back, like, access to stuff but don't get any money is that it is enough, right? Like, that's basically what they're saying. Gabe, does that seem like a fair thing for me to say? That's the argument that they're making is that it's quote-unquote enough?
Yeah, that sounds fair.
Okay, so I may have told you guys this. It's not a big deal, but my new thing that I do now when I ride the subway is I bought a Kindle and I keep it in my bag and I read my Kindle. Like, I've read a whole lot of books in the course of the last few months. If you live in New York, I suggest you get an actual Kindle. It gets you off from looking at the phone all the time and stuff like that. It's a good thing. And so I've been reading a lot of books, and a book I'm reading now is Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos and Community by Martin Luther King. My understanding is that you guys are really big into Martin Luther King. There's even a holiday named after him, right? Anyway, as I've been reading Chaos and Community, I found this paragraph that I think is interesting, and I think you should consider it in the context of what we're discussing. He says, "These are the deepest causes for contemporary abrasions between the races. Loose and easy language about equality, resonant resolutions about brotherhood fall pleasantly on the ear. Before the Negro, there is a credibility gap he cannot overlook. He remembers that with each modest advance, the white population promptly raises the argument that the Negro has come far enough. Each step forward accents an ever-present tendency to backlash." You hear that word enough come up right there? Enough. You ain't got to give the players no money because they got enough, but you protect and defend the right of everybody around the players to make as much money as they possibly can. The coaches get to make as much money as they possibly can. The schools get as much money as they possibly can. And don't forget that this trickles on down, right? So when you're building the new recruiting center or whatever it is, or a player center that you use for recruiting, somebody's company is getting the contract to build that thing. Somebody getting that money. And you know who that person is that's getting that money? It's probably somebody white. You see what I mean? Like, you know who, like, administratively, like, who the coaches are in college football. They're overwhelmingly white. Who the athletic directors are, they're overwhelmingly white. The university presidents, they're overwhelmingly white. The people that they get in to do all this other stuff is overwhelmingly white. Hell, the people in the crowd, overwhelmingly white. The only thing that is even close to integrated, like, truly integrated about college football is the field. And even that's a little tricky because they're running out of places for white dudes to play. Like, now that there are no white dudes out there, but you understand what I'm saying? It ain't as many of them as it used to be, right? Why is that the case? Talk to the people that make those decisions, not me. But that's what we got. We got a whole bunch of white dudes making all the money in the world, and somebody trying to explain to the black dudes who have no money why what they have is enough. And yes, there are white dudes that are out there playing, and they, you know, I don't want to pretend as though there are no white athletes out there, and I think they should be paid. But when you imagine that college athlete in your mind, you know who it is that you imagine. When it comes time to talk about paying them, you know who the image is that comes up in your mind. You know who it is. It is also worth noting, I think, and I'd love for somebody to do some measure of research on this, because I've had this idea, but I've never like seen it put into action, which is it always seems to me that the white dudes who make it as big time athletes, they tend to come from money. Like, you know, them hardship stories they be telling during the draft about all the black dudes. Like, Gabe, I don't know if you watched the draft this year, man, but Trey Wingo, he just had index card after index card of miserable stories. Man, people dying, people going to jail, people little sleeping three to a bed, like all that stuff. All those stories are rattled off. It ain't never about the white dudes. It ain't never about the white dudes, which is interesting because people really do believe in poverty as being this great motivator to put people in positions to be successful, right? But the white dudes that you see in them positions, they didn't need no poverty. They didn't need no poverty battery pack in their asses in order to get it done. They just got there. So you can't subtract those things from when you hear these discussions, and it's just like, no, you guys are getting enough. And then you wind up with this. Like, we got Mike Leach. Where somebody asked Mike Leach about this California law?
Maybe we ought to just have minor league football and have minor, go ahead and have minor league football, and then those guys can do whatever they want, you know. But the state of California has trouble keeping their streets clean right now, so my thought is that they probably ought to focus on that. That's just one guy's opinion, and I'm sure I'm probably wrong. But, you know, but at the rate that California is handling their infrastructure and some of their other problems, you know, I think that we'll see how they do with that before I really think it would be that beneficial for the legislature of California to enter into college football. And if you see benefits to them entering into college football, I'd love to hear, because they seem to be determined to do it.
Bro, what are you talking about? That didn't have any, like, the minor league football point is an interesting one just because of what the draw is for a lot of people about college football. And in fact, if you took the same players and then put them in minor league football uniforms, they may have realized that the football is actually not that good and then not watch it. Right? Like, if you want to talk about that, that I do think is a discussion that people even on my side of the argument need to be honest about, which is there is a certain nostalgia that comes into why people, like, consume these things, and that if you made it minor league football, we wouldn't be that interested. Right? Okay. That's a discussion to be had. All that time they wasted passing that bill. What'd you think? The legislature was going to be out there in the streets with brooms, sweeping up the streets, achieving your goal? Is that what it was? Like what? What is this? But you see how quickly that went to an explicitly political place in discussing this. Right? And I'm just like, hey, man, why does the idea of them boys making money make you so mad? It's not going to cost most of you a thing. Why does this make you so mad? I would also like to know something for Tebow, just while I'm thinking about it. He talked about why the college stadiums are so much bigger. Because, nah, bro, those college stadiums are so much bigger. The college stadiums that are really big and that fill up, you know what about all of them have in common? They in places where there ain't nothing else to do. Like, Gabe, you went to UCLA. Tell the people where y'all play your home games.
The Rose Bowl.
Rose Bowl got 100,000 seats, right?
Correct.
Y'all ever fill it up for home games?
No.
Okay. The Coliseum for USC, isn't that what, like 95,000 seats?
Yeah, it's a big one.
They can't fill that up unless it's like a great game. And this is a city with like 6-7 million people.
Yeah, I mean, they section off a whole area of the stadium where it's the Legends area, kind of like the Raiders do with the tarp.
Right. All right. It's like, yo, so where is your passion for college football because of all these things that you talked about? Nah, man, they got other stuff to do in those places. Yeah, they go put 100,000 people in Baton Rouge. Where else you about to go? And I don't mean this as disrespect. I can appreciate the quaint rural life. I'm just saying, in those places, there is nothing better to do than go to a college football game. And hey, going to a college football game, it's a pretty good thing to do. Like, I'm not saying that you're choosing like a substandard activity to participate in. I'm just telling you, in the places where people got better stuff to do, like I lived in Miami, for example. It's funny when you go to the wiki, because the wiki for season by season with all these teams will tell you the attendance on all the games. You go look at Miami, like even when they were at their best, when they had a big game, like they would fill up the Orange Bowl for Florida State, or they'll fill up Hard Rock now for a good game. But when they go play some scrubs, ain't nobody going. Why? Because if I'm going to go sit outside in Miami all day long, I can find a better place to do within Miami Gardens. I can find a better place to do within the Orange Bowl. You know what it's called? The beach. I can go do it at the beach. That's why all them people going to them big old stadiums, because they ain't got nowhere else to go. Come on, man. You know what time it is. You ain't got to lie about this stuff. If the people put it like this, just tell me this, and I say this and we'll move on. If you don't think that those dudes should get paid, why are people willing to break the law to do it? Because let me tell you who does believe that them boys deserve to get paid. The local boosters. They believe it. They 100% believe that those dudes will get paid. And I would actually love to see that poll taken, by the way. A poll among boosters about how they feel about the idea of paying college athletes. Because I would love to know just how many of them dudes don't think the athletes should get a check from the school, but then give $100 handshakes every Saturday. All right, breaking news, guys. Breaking news, guys. Eli Manning is now headed to the Pine. We're going into week three, and Daniel Jones will be the Giants' starting quarterback. I am one of those people who has not been sure about this Daniel Jones thing. It didn't seem like a good idea to take him number six. I didn't see that many people whom I trusted who thought he was a first-round quarterback. He did look pretty good in the preseason, so I guess we'll see how this ultimately goes. But that sounds to me like the Eli Manning era is over. And, Gabe, I ask you, is this going to get the coach fired like the last coach got fired for putting Eli Manning on the bench?
I don't know. Have they turned a page since then? There's been a power struggle there.
I think the turn of the page was the fact that they drafted the quarterback in the first place. And Eli looked pretty bad in the first 2 weeks of the season. This is my only question. If you were going to pull the plug on Eli after two games, why did you even bring him back? Like, why didn't y'all have that talk with him at the end of the season and say, hey, man, it's time for you to retire? Right, because now, like, after he played the first week, they're on the hook for the rest of his salary. Even they wanted to release him or whatever, the rest of his salary is guaranteed. Why did you even do this? Like, it's been obvious that this dude's been done for so long. Like, I never had a great answer to when exactly it was they were going to look up and be like, not only is Eli done, he's so done that we're going to pull him out. Because simply being done wasn't enough for him to lose his job. He lost his job that last time to, honestly, a better quarterback than him. And I don't know why people can't admit this. When they benched Eli Manning for Geno Smith, Geno Smith was the better quarterback. You go look at, like, the last handful of games that Geno Smith had played versus the last handful of games that Eli Manning had played. Geno, at that point, was a younger, better option than Eli Manning was. The problem is, once y'all decide a black quarterback isn't good, there's nothing that's going to change your mind about it, right? So, yeah, and Geno was pretty bad with the Jets, but throw him out there in a hopeless situation with no receivers to throw to, nothing else good going on around the team, and then determine that the dude is terrible forever, like when he's 24, 25 years old. But then tell me Taysom Hill should probably be the quarterback of the Saints. All right. Once y'all decide that a dude is not good, y'all don't ride off of it when it's the black quarterback. That's the curse of being the black quarterback, right? And so you put Geno Smith in, and people found that to be such an indignity to Eli Manning that the coach got fired and Eli got to keep his job for like two more years. Like a legitimate two more years after that, man. That's absurd. He got to keep his job another two more years. And now they put Daniel Jones out there. Good luck to him, because, I mean, Eli's not good, but neither is anything else that is surrounding that football team. Now, Gabe, I got an interesting statistic for you. Do you know what Eli Manning's career record is in the regular season?
Is it below 500?
It is 116 and 116.
Ooh, almost like, did you see that Bruce Bochy stat? I want to say it was last week, where he had the exact same number of wins in his career as he did losses.
Really?
Like, for his entire career. People are like, oh, time to retire now. So if that's how it is with Eli, maybe he should just call it quits.
That's exactly how I saw it with Eli. I'm like, yo, no, this is when you walk out of the casino, right? You were up big, right? You're not going to get back up big. Now it's time for you to walk. I want to know if Eli walked into the office and was like, hey, coach, I just think it's time for a change. I just think it's time to move on. And that, I mean, I don't find that to be unreasonable. Would you find that to be unreasonable?
Not at all.
I would not find that to be unreasonable. I'm out of here. What am I still playing for? I really don't know what Eli came back for. Did Eli think he was going to get this thing back together? Or did he just want the check? Because if he just wanted the check, that's fine. I respect that. But I don't even know why he put himself through this. Through an off season of working out and getting ready
and all that, and now you're just going to be sitting there watching Daniel Jones? What, you going to be over there helping him? Here's my question. Here's what Eli can help you with, because this is the thing you have to say about Eli Manning's career, and this will be the defining characteristic of his career, and it is not the two Super Bowls. It is not the two Super Bowl MVPs. It is 15 drama-free years. Right? Like, he knew how to navigate being the quarterback in New York in a way that seems borderline impossible to do. Like, Derek Jeter did it with the Yankees, but Derek Jeter was kicking it different, though, because you still get, you know, Derek Jeter was, you know, he was on them. So you still got word about that kind of stuff. Eli Manning, even when he was bad, man, he handled this. He rode this straight through. He absolutely did. Like, that is going to be the defining thing about him and the time that he's been there and everything else. And I do think he deserves a measure of credit for that. Past that, guys, let's just get this out here. Eli Manning, he might make the Hall of Fame, but he ain't no Hall of Famer. He's just not. The dude was never better than an average quarterback in the NFL. Happened to be on the right teams, happened to have the right last name, happened to be involved in two of the luckiest plays in the history of the NFL postseason. But, gotta say, seems like a pretty good dude. He does. Seems like a pretty good dude. So, I wish no ill upon him. I wish him the best. And if you're a Giants fan, you should love him. He was the quarterback of your team for all that time. Like, it was a legitimate era. He was quarterback of the team all that time. You got Super Bowls. Heap praise upon him. Thank him for the memories. The rest of us, don't put that dude in the Hall of Fame.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from entertainment.
Hi, I'm Dave Itzkoff, and I'm a culture reporter for the New York Times. My story today is about Shane Gillis, a comedian who, it was announced just last week, was going to join the cast of Saturday Night Live as a featured performer for its upcoming season, but who, on Monday, it was announced, had been dropped from the show before he'd ever appeared on it. And that's because within hours of the announcement on Thursday that Gillis had been hired for the program, journalists who cover the comedy beat and other fans and comedy aficionados helped to resurface past videos in which Gillis could be seen and heard using ethnic slurs and other bigoted language. And this set off a days-long debate or controversy online about whether it was even appropriate to hire Gillis when it seemed like he had been using this kind of language in his work, or whether his work at all really was comedic, or if this was just an example of somebody using comedy as an excuse to say offensive things. It took a few days for Saturday Night Live to respond to the situation, but in a statement that the show and its creator, Lorne Michaels, put out on Monday, they acknowledged that the language that Gillis had used in these videos was offensive, hurtful, and unacceptable. The show also said that it was not aware and did not see these clips before it hired Gillis, and acknowledged that its vetting process, bringing him onto the program, did not meet its own standards.
I do have one question, though, about, like, the vetting of something like that. How exactly do you do it? You know what I mean? Like, so how do you go about checking enough of someone's previous work that you catch what that guy had been saying? And I'm not saying that, like, defensively or dismissively. Like, I'm actually very curious. I don't know how exactly you go about finding that. But this dude here, here's what amazes me about this. And I guess maybe you just decided that you're going to make, like, being the offensive comedian is going to be your bag. You've just decided. But the dude, did you see his statement after this happened?
Yes, I did.
And I want to read this to people. It feels ridiculous for comedians to be making serious public statements, but here we are. I'm a comedian who was funny enough to get SNL. That can't be taken away. Of course, I wanted an opportunity to prove myself at SNL, but I understand it would be too much of a distraction. I respect the decision they made. I'm honestly grateful for the opportunity. I was always a Mad TV guy anyway. Like, yo, that's defiant, right? Like, that implies to me you have not considered for a moment what anybody else has said. Like, and apparently the only Asian guy he's talked to is Andrew Yang, who apparently is going to have a meetup with him. But, yo, man, like, I saw some of the stuff that – I heard some of the stuff that Buddy was saying, you know, if you're going to be a comedian, you got to take risks. That stuff wasn't risky. It was just bad and offensive. Like, being offensive for its own sake is not a risk. Being offensive for his own sake in order to get laughs,
Literally, anybody on the street can do that. Like, if you're supposed to be a professional, that doesn't seem to be, to me, something that you need to do. Like, you say you were funny enough to get SNL. Well, if you as dope as you're trying to say you are, you probably should have been dope enough to figure out another way. Now, if you want to say, in reality, I'm just not funny enough unless I got to go to these cheap gags. Oh, okay. Then go ahead. Do that, right? But if you're going to be the, like, I'm the offensive comic and I need to, like, you know, do that or whatever, stay in that lane. But the lane for you, if you're doing that, is not going on Saturday Night Live, right? Like, that is and I don't want to call that stuff edgy because it's more sophomoric than anything else. But that ain't the place for what you're doing. Stay in your lane, buddy. And if you want to be over there and be a jerk about this, I mean, all right, cool, that's fine. Go tell them jokes over and over and over again if that is what works for you. But you're going to stay right over there in those places where you are, and you ain't going to get the stuff like Saturday Night Live that you clearly want because you're clearly sad that you didn't get it.
All right, Bomani, this next story comes from Defense.
I'm Kim Bellware with the Washington Post, and last week a story that caught my eye was a pair of Dutch YouTube personalities who were arrested in rural Nevada for allegedly trying to trespass into an Air Force facility outside of the area that is best known to us civilians as Area 51. The two Dutch nationals, Thies Granger and Govert Sweep, were each charged with trespassing and held at the Nye County Detention Center, which is about 250 miles north of Las Vegas. The two had been driving through the area, they were doing a tour, and when they came across this alien gift shop, the Area 51 Alien Center as it's known, they heard a little bit of information from one of the locals that there was this Storm Area 51 event coming up. And for those of you who may have heard that name in the past couple weeks, it is this viral internet sensation that a college student started as a joke. Eventually, this joke turned into more than 2 million people saying they wanted to come check it out and storm Area 51, go through everything. It's something that's put the locals in a total frenzy, worried about the massive visitors that would totally overwhelm the small rural Nevada area. The creator has since sort of disavowed the event. He's programmed against it, but there is a local who's trying to keep it going. It's something that the authorities are kind of grappling with ongoing, hoping that come September 20th, when the event was originally scheduled, a mass of humanity doesn't show up. But back to our two Dutch YouTubers, they were caught, their vehicle was searched, they found cameras, drones, video equipment, laptops, and the two spent a few nights in the Nye County Jail. According to their YouTube, though, they've since been released.
Fine. I tried to tell people not to go down there. Go. Do it. Let me know how it goes.
We're just a couple of days now from the supposed meetup.
Yeah, let me know how it works out, guys. We'll put you on the show next week. Apparently that's what y'all want. We'll keep you on the show. Fine.
We're going to have to update this story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Go down there. Yeah. Come back. Take pictures. Put it on YouTube. Put it on Instagram. I'm sure you'll be on IG Live.
What I loved about this, too, was that they've got cameras. They've got drones. They're ready.
Dummies. How do they even have the time? How do you have the time and the money to do this? Like, why aren't you at work?
They're YouTubers, so their work is basically just documenting their own lives.
Yeah, I guess that's a great point. Go get a real job so you don't do this. All right, that's the only reason. Just so you don't do this. A real job might save your life. I mean, jobs have saved many a lives, right? Go get a job to save your own life.
All right, this last story comes from Tech.
Hi, this is Josh Wilbur. I'm a freelance writer based out of New York City. In an article for Slate called God's Conversion Rate, I wrote about how churches are using targeted advertising on platforms like Facebook and Instagram to reach people in their communities. My article explores how digital advertising is empowering churches to evangelize to precisely those individuals they want to reach, especially young people. While many churches are struggling to keep their doors open, others are having lots of success with targeted ads, using tools like lookalike audiences and geofencing. I heard about one social media team who wanted to bring more families into the church, so they targeted an elementary school between the hours of 3 and 4 p.m. when parents wait to pick up their kids from school. There are lots of ways on Facebook's advertising platform to specify and reach exactly the person whom you want to receive your message. The article is ultimately concerned with the question of how these religious institutions can stay relevant and speak the language of the culture while also respecting individuals' privacy and staying true to Christianity's foundational beliefs.
Got to do what you got to do, huh, Gabe?
You got to fish where the fish are.
Look, man, they just shot a,
They just trying to get you to put in that direct deposit form so they can get them ties, man. They like, look, man, they can't put, they ain't putting nothing in this plate if they ain't coming in the crowd. So we got to do something. We got to figure something out. But no, this is, I mean, because in theory, like a lot of people I know, they do the church thing like through internet stuff, like they watch services and stuff like that. But I do imagine something has to be lost in, like, this is like going to college online, right? Like there has to, something has to be lost by not getting in with the commune, like meeting with your people, building a community and stuff like that. Like it seems like there's a real argument trying to get people there. So I don't really blame them for trying to use the internet or whatever it is to get them to come in. The only thing about it is like the types of advertisements that work to get people to go do stuff and to get in, like you're going to have to be kind of like flashy and maybe a little uncomfortable with it, right?
Yeah, completely.
Like it's just, I mean, like if all that matters is getting them in, then what is your line on what you're willing to do to get them in? Because I could understand the argument that what matters is getting them in. Yeah, man. 21st century. It's wild stuff. But it's also, it's interesting always to me watching, like, when technology collides with churches, how uncomfortable it can make people, even though, like, I remember the first time I saw somebody, I was watching on TV or something, and somebody brought an iPad up to the pulpit, all right? Or like hearing people like who bring their Bibles on their iPads. And people are like, oh, like, okay, it's just the way that you brought it, right? Like it's fundamentally no different than bringing a book, although I guess there's always been a metaphorical significance that people have placed to the physical copy of the Bible. But, you know, when little things happen that are just like advances in the technology, it throws people off. And so this kind of advertisement, I mean, it really makes perfect sense that you would do it. Just to get people in. Like, I got you. But, you know, it's with the creepy Facebookness of it. And so all of it just gets thrown together in the blender. And then we just have to realize it's just 2019.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bo, so there wasn't a particular event that spawned this discussion, this topic for this week's voicemail segment, but we decided that it would be interesting to reach out to the listeners to see if they had any interesting stories about a heckling incident that may have gone too far. Our first one comes from Kyle in Huntington Beach.
What's up, Bo? It's Kyle from Huntington Beach. I used to play for Arizona State. We played Oregon in 94. They beat us to clinch a spot in the Rose Bowl. Their fans rushed the field. A bunch of them were spitting on our guys, were flipping our guys off. They ended up spitting and flipping off our right guard. Our right guard decided to punch that dude in the face.
Lesson learned.
What this reminded me of was in 2009, I don't know if you remember when
I know what you're talking about.
Oregon played against Boise State.
Yep.
And our man LeGarrette Blount unloaded on another player.
Yeah, that heckling took place on the field. Like LeGarrette Blount was whack for that. But I've always said the lucky people were the people in the crowd that were heckling him on the way out that he did not serve up. Because, like, I didn't think the dude on the field necessarily deserved it. Those people in the crowd did.
One thing that can happen when the court gets stormed, when the field gets stormed, people go up to athletes, talk some mess.
Yeah.
And you never know. You get knocked out, man.
Yep. Keep it in mind. Keep it in mind.
All right. This next one has a little bit of a different tone to it than the first one, but it's still a good one. It's from Joel in Champaign.
Hi, my name's Joel from Champaign, Illinois. A few years ago, some friends and I went up to Chicago to watch a baseball game. Kansas City Royals at the White Sox. We were sitting in center field and spent the whole game heckling Lorenzo Cain. Nothing mean or nasty, just weird stuff like, do you want to come over to our Airbnb and crash on the futon? Do you ever get tired of Danny Duffy? They ignored us the entire time. The only time he even looked at us was when we made fun of Kansas City barbecue. Lorenzo Cain then went on to go 2-for-3 in that game with a home run and a walk. And the home run he hit landed almost exactly 10 feet exactly behind where we were sitting. A kid in a White Sox jersey caught it. And I'm going to say what we did was bully that kid into throwing the ball back on the field, and then he immediately got ejected from the game. That was the top of the sixth inning. The rest of the game we spent making fun of Lorenzo Cain, asking him if he felt bad about getting that kid ejected. He clearly didn't. Kansas City would go on to win that game 2-1, and as soon as they got the last out in the bottom of the ninth, Lorenzo Cain just turned around, gave us a little shrug and a little head tilt like, "What's up? How you like me now?" And all we could do is just stand up and applaud him. And now whenever anybody asks me who my favorite non-Chicago White Sox player is, I always tell them Lorenzo Cain.
I respect him applauding him in that moment. Because if I was a center fielder, every game I'd invite somebody to come down on the field, you the winner of the contest. Come see what it's like to engage in athleticism on the field. And there's nothing more athletic than fighting.
What makes baseball different, I would say, when it comes to heckling is that you have a captive audience with these outfielders.
Yes.
Not as much center because they can play a little bit more shallow, but they're out there and they're just standing on the field with full view of the hecklers for hours and hours and hours of the game.
Oh, yeah. They can hear you. They can hear you.
Whether they're fans or not, right?
And it's not that loud.
Exactly. It's dead quiet.
Yep. They can hear you.
All right. This last one comes from Adam in D.C.
Hey, Bomani, this is Adam from Washington, D.C. This story is a little bit off the beaten path about a heckler. It's happened in the sport of cyclocross. This is a sport where people race bicycles off-road on very small courses. So imagine fans being able to get right up against the tape and watch the action. Well, Sven Nys is a Belgian cyclist, arguably one of the greatest of all time. He is having a very tough race. He's crashed maybe three or four times. It's really muddy and cold out. There's a section of the course with rowdy fans that are yelling and screaming and drinking. And toward the end of the race, he gets hit with a red party cup, and the cup was filled with beer. Sven stops, gets off his bike very calmly, walks under the tape. The guy who threw it is now running through the crowd to get away from him. Sven catches up to him. You don't really see a lot what happens. All you see is his finger in his face and the guy just kind of looking down at the ground and nodding, kind of like a parent would be scolding a young child. Sven turns around, walks back through the crowd really calmly under the tape, gets back on his bike, finishes the race like a true professional. The thing that I took away from it most was the professional way that he handled the whole thing.
Yeah, I guess. Let me tell you this. That man come up there and put his finger in your face, you better not look down. You know what I'm saying? Like, no, dog, you better not look down. Because I feel like that would make me want to slap you more than if you look me in the eye. Right? You look down, hey, look at me when I'm talking to you.
The shame.
Yeah.
Did he honestly think that when he threw a full cup onto the track that he would not get accosted for that?
Right. Hey, man, look, Ron Artest ain't that unique. World full of people that's going to come at you for throwing something at him. You kidding me?
It's Europeans, man. Too polite.
Yeah, I guess. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. Thanks to our contributors to If You Haven't Heard. Thanks to Dave Itzkoff with The New York Times. Check out his story on Shane Gillis getting dropped from Saturday Night Live. Also, thanks to Kim Bellware of The Washington Post. Check out her story on some Dutch vloggers arrested for trying to get into Area 51. And thanks to Josh Wilbur of Slate. Check out his story about churches using targeted ads in order to attract members. Be sure to check out the Woj Pod. He chatted with Doc Rivers and Heat Coach Eric Spoelstra. Be sure to subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater, and we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear. More driven.